Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. It's good to be back. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Joel Johnson. Joel is the economist for the Maine Center of Economic Policy. Welcome, Joel.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, the theme song, Money, you know, we're not going to necessarily talk about money exactly, but really economic conditions here in Maine, economic policy, and our economic future. And really, for Maine and any state or any country, the economic realities have such an influence on every other area of day-to-day life, whether it's healthcare, education, job creation. So it's all about money, money, money. Before we talk about what's going on in Maine, why don't you just kind of introduce yourself in the context of what you're, you know, doing your current job. And first of all, I guess we'll start with how you ended up coming to Maine and where you grew up and how you got here to Maine, and we'll talk about a little bit about what you're doing here and relative to our economy.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Maine. I started fourth grade in Orono, Maine, and went to Orono Middle School, Orono High School. Had some great teachers there. I was really lucky to have some excellent English teachers, math teachers. And before that, I moved around. I was born in Michigan and moved around as a young boy. And then landed in Maine and grew up here.
Well, fantastic. And looks like you went to school ultimately at Grinnell College in Iowa, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I went out to the cornfields of Iowa, the rolling hills. It's really, really pretty out there, about 6 miles off of Interstate 80.
Wow.
Exit 182. And really enjoyed it. It's a great school, and I'd recommend it to anybody.
And then later on, you came back to UMaine to earn a master's in resource economics and policy, is that right?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I graduated college. I didn't really know exactly where I was headed or didn't really have much of a plan. I came back to Maine. I actually spent 4 years doing work in the tourism industry. I lived down in Bar Harbor and got my guide license and was doing kayak tours. You know, renting bikes and, you know, that kind of thing.
Did you do tours around that disappearing island right out in front where, it's one of my favorite places to
stay? Bar Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a sandbar that's really, it's not just sand, there's rocks in this formation. And at low tide, this roadway where people drive out to Bar Island, drive out, and then there's kayaking on both sides. And then as the tide comes in, it literally disappears, and I think there's like 6 or 10 feet of water at high tide. And historically, there's always some tourist who gets stuck out on the island, like they fall asleep, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, the tides in Maine are big, and they're the tidal range is bigger the further down east you go.
Right.
You know, Bar Harbor's about 2/3 of the way down
to
the end of the state, and yeah, the tide range there is big. It can be, you know, it can be 14 feet. Sometimes during certain cycles of the moon between high and low tide.
How about popovers? You ever head up to Jordan Pond for some popovers?
Once in a while. I was more of a thirsty whale, get a fish sandwich kind of guy, you know, and go to, you know, have a Bar Harbor real ale.
I know, but I think the popovers are one of our biggest economic stimuli elements. I think people travel from around the world to go to Jordan Pond. Have you been there, Dylan?
I have.
Aren't they something
delish
with the strawberry or the raspberry jam?
Delish.
Yeah. You're only supposed to get a couple with your meal. But if you're really nice and you kind of like, you know, ask for another one, or if you kind of grab one out of the basket, oh, those are fantastic.
Good stuff.
So you ended up coming back. So talk a little bit about how you entered the area of being an economist, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Maine Economic Forecasting Commission, which you're part of now, and then we'll talk about what's going on here in Maine.
Sure. Well, you know, I was, like I said, I was living down in Bar Harbor, and I also did some work with kids. You know, I was doing child care kind of work at a place called Kids Peace there in Ellsworth, and I sort of felt like I wanted to do something different. I was really obsessed at that point in time. It was around 2005 with oil prices. In oil supply, I started reading all about the, you know, this sort of peak oil theory, which is kind of this frightening Malthusian theory about resource depletion and things. And I decided I wanted to, you know, pursue that a little more. So I went to UMaine. I studied resource economics and policy. Did two year master's degree there. Wrote a thesis.
How big of a department is that? I haven't heard about that specific department in UMaine. I was interested to see that in your background.
Yeah, well, that's actually they've combined it now with the regular economics department, and I don't know how many faculty they have there now. I think it's I want to say 10 or 12 at least. They'd probably slap their foreheads if they heard me say that. To be honest, I'm not sure how many faculty are there, but it's a very good department. They do world-class research in certain areas of natural resource valuation, energy economics, waste economics, things like that.
Okay, and then talk a little bit about your career path. Where after you graduated, where did you end up, and then how that transitioned into your current role?
Sure. So I got my degree at UMaine, my master's degree, and I ended up going to my first job. I got a job with the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection. I was working under a federal fellowship, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and I was doing some GIS work and sort of sea level rise kind of mapping and preparation, kind of coastal hazards, resilience, that sort of thing. Connecticut's got a much lower lying coastland than Maine does, a lot of marshes, a lot of development in very low elevation areas along the coast, and they're really preparing for, you know, stronger storms and, generally speaking, a rising sea level over the next coming decades.
I didn't hear you mention the magic words climate change. was any of that work based on that, or was, you know, is any of the work of you as an economist relative to helping with the mapping, is it based also on science of projected climate change?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're developing maps with that use, you know, some of the estimates that are in the literature out there, in the geology literature, really, in the climate literature about, you know, forecasted sea level rise. I mean, obviously, it's a very difficult undertaking to do that kind of forecasting. But I mean, you know, the physics, I think, is pretty clear. And
the literature isn't just literature. It's literature predicated on facts and science and isotopes and acidity levels and our depleting Antarctica. The reason I look over at Deb is... you know, Deb has a completely different view.
Well, it helps if you include all data in your models.
And do you think all the scientists aren't doing that?
Well, the latest one did not.
Oh, come on.
It eliminated the temperatures in the poles. Now, that's 33% of the globe. Wouldn't you think that would be important to include?
If 99% of the world's scientists, these are scientists, Deb. They're not
scientists
politicians.
Scientists that didn't use all the data.
No,
shocking.
They don't watch Fox News. They have no political agenda. Our good friend Joel Johnson, who's here, who's the economist for the Maine Center of Economics, he doesn't have an agenda. So we're going to get derailed here. So we'll do another show on climate change, but we'll check this off that you believe in it, and we'll move forward.
Well, you know, I mean, the other things that you can look at, so there are very serious people and institutions around the world that are taking it seriously and preparing. I mean, you got the Swiss reinsurance industry, you got the, you know, military are all, you know,
the military,
taking this seriously.
The military have declared that climate change is one of the greatest military factors we're going to be facing in the next few decades, because as soon as, you know, countries and shoreline and sure, as soon as economies are dramatically affected, it will have a cause and effect on conflicts. So the military is looking at it. Manhattan is going down. That's kind of a big deal. And, you know, this isn't about just saving the puffins and the penguins, because Deb cares about the puffins and the penguins, but moving right along. So how did you end up coming back to Maine, and what was your first role in Maine, and what are you doing now?
So I took a job with the State Planning Office as an economist, and I was doing, you know, population forecasting there. I wrote an annual report and did a lot of research and analysis around municipal and state finances. There's a report that has to be written every year under state law that tracks progress towards, you might recall, a law that we passed back in 2005 called LD1, and that's all about kind of state and local finances. So I would do that sort of analysis, and a lot of just kind of ad hoc problem solving around the economy, around Maine's forest economy, a variety of things. But that was at the state planning office. I was there for a couple years, and then I took the current position I have now at the Maine Center for Economic Policy.
And then you also serve on the Consensus Economic Forecasting Commission, is that right?
I do right now, although the commission's going to be sort of refreshed here. And, you know, I'm not sure if I'll be on the commission going forward, but over the last 2 years I have been serving as a forecaster on the commission.
Okay, let's talk about Maine. Let's talk about our economy, but let's start with a couple of kind of current event issues that are going on. As most of our listeners know, Maine and our legislature work on a two-year budget cycle, biennial budget, and it typically occurs in the first 6 months of each of every other year in the legislative session with the new legislative elected body. So we're right in the middle of that. And there's some controversy. Governor LePage has, from the executive branch of our state government, has proposed some fairly dramatic changes in overall tax policy. We want to talk about estate tax. We also want to talk about his proposal to start taxing charities, mm-hmm. and the impact that has, mm-hmm. and also the change in revenue sharing with 488 municipalities. So in no particular order, if you can give kind of an overview on the current discussions on how we form a budget, because over the next few months, the governor, in conjunction with the state legislature, they're holding meetings, they're holding hearings. One way or the other, they have to hammer out a budget that will impact Maine for many, many years, but it is a two-year budget. So if you can give some of the highlights from your position with as an economist and as part of the economic policy, what are your thoughts in terms of some of these big proposals, and just kind of go down the list from revenue sharing, estate taxes, charity, and those elements, and then we'll talk about some other issues.
Sure. So the governor's proposal, the cornerstone of it is, and his number one policy priority, if you listen to his speeches and you listen to his comments, and also if you just look at the budget document, is a very large income tax cut, cut to the personal income tax. And in addition, a proposal to eliminate the estate tax. And also there's some corporate income tax cuts built into the budget. And those are all very expensive. The income tax cut that he's proposing is about $610 million a year in 2019. And that's against the current income tax. The forecast for that year is supposed to bring in about $1.6 billion. So it's a pretty big it's a pretty big income tax cut, mm-hmm. and he wants to pay for that by raising the sales tax from up to 6.5%. Right now it's at 5.5%. It's scheduled to sunset back to the old rate of 5% in July. He wants to permanently set it at 6.5%, and in addition, he wants to expand the sales tax to a variety of new previously untaxed services, and they include basically amusement and recreation services. So we're talking ski tickets, golf greens fees, water parks, whatever, those kinds of things. There's also a bunch of domestic and household services in there that he wants to tax.
Aren't there legal fees too?
Yeah, and also legal services.
Those are kind of amusement. I was going to make a joke about lawyers. That's kind of a fun house kind of thing.
That's a blast.
Yeah. Dealing with lawyers is just so – it's entertaining. There should be a state tax. So talk about – first of all, that element. Let's – because there's so many elements, and as you said, it's complex. But I was for years chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council, involved with setting our town budget. And there's a lot of moving parts. And on the local municipality level, you only have, by law – so many levers you can pull relative to generating revenue.
Sure.
And, excise tax, property tax are some of the main ones. There's fees and some service stuff. But generally, in terms of income taxation, it's state and it's federal law. But the state has a lot of levers. And right now it feels like, you know, the state facing some real challenges. There, you know, Governor LePage is trying to pull all the levers, and there's a lot of moving parts. So let's talk about a couple of them at a point by point. What's your thought about changing the income tax? How does that compare to possibly other states? And what is the cause of effect if you're trying to reduce the income tax? Local municipalities will face more of a burden, so they have to raise property taxes, which is really one of their own only mechanisms. And then the idea of sales tax is the idea that it's such a small percent and it's baked into purchases that people won't directly feel the pain. Or, you know, from an economist standpoint, what's the thinking behind what is being proposed by Governor LePage?
Well, the governor's sort of foundational belief in that's driving this proposal is that he thinks that the state, that personal income, corporate income, and the estate tax are all the most critical taxes in terms of the state's this sort of vague idea of competitiveness with other states in terms of, you know, our business climate and the climate for wealthy individuals who might want to live here or move here and invest. And so that's why his goal is to cut the income tax, the personal income tax, and eliminate the estate tax. Now, the problem with that is that, first of all, the sales tax increases he's proposing don't make up for the size of those income tax cuts. And so it's not just sales tax increases that are paying for those income tax cuts. It's also spending cuts. And the biggest of those spending cuts is the elimination of this routine aid, about $150, $160 million a year that the state sends back to municipalities through a formula. It's called municipal revenue sharing. And that's an important source of revenue for a lot of municipalities around the state. And then there's an additional about a $90 million in annual spending cuts going out to fiscal 19 that the governor hasn't identified yet. And the reason is because he's got basically this big 4 to 5, 6 year tax plan, but he's only specified the spending side of the state's balance sheet for the next 2 years. And so we see that as problematic because there's basically unspecified spending cuts in there. And it also leaves the state very little wiggle room at all to deal with any kind of economic downturn where we start seeing some increasing costs on the spending side of the state's balance sheet. It's going to force deep cuts to things that actually really are important to the state's economy, like education and roads and bridges and job training and healthcare and a variety of things. So that's kind of the one of the problems that we see. The other thing is that this whole idea that the state's competitiveness economically is driven by our marginal personal income tax rates or the existence of an estate tax, I think, is overstated. I think that the evidence from the academic literature doesn't bear it out. The evidence from the economic experience of other states doesn't really bear it out that these personal income and estate taxes are as important as the governor thinks they are.
Right. You mentioned a big issue that's drawing a lot of attention is the revenue sharing from local municipalities and the percent. But it's more than just a formula. It was actually law, and it was actually established with certain parameters and thresholds. And what the governor is attempting to do is basically changing that contract, literally and figuratively, that the state has with towns, saying that if you pay in X amount, you will get X amount. So I think it's a little more fundamental than just recommending a budget shift. It's really changing, I don't want to say our constitution, but changing a key element on how the state operates. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, then that's the argument that I've heard municipal leadership making is that, you know, this isn't just a budget decision. I mean, revenue sharing, the state policymakers have been cutting revenue sharing back for the last, since the recession, basically on an annual basis. And now the proposal to eliminate it, I mean, a lot of municipal leaders really see that as kind of a violation of a partnership and of a sort of agreement or a contract that state government and local government in Maine have had for 40 years. And that's So they see it as that in addition to the budget impacts on towns, which are right. which are significant.
Do you want to hear my economic plan? By the way, we have Joel Johnson here. He is an economist for the Maine Center of Economic Policy. By the way, their website is MECEP.org. I think I have the answer, Joel.
Okay.
Are you familiar with my plan?
I'm not, Steve.
Really?
Maybe
I should have done my research.
No. This is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And our good friend Charlie Kogan was sitting right where you are over the last few years, and we got into many spirited debates on this until I drove him out of town. Here is my economic plan. It's predicated on a couple core principles. One, we get too focused here on Maine on small economics with a small e versus big, you know. And somebody opens up a local bakery up the street, which is nice, you know, because who doesn't love a good Napoleon or an eclair? I know I do, but that bakery may create a few jobs, but it's not creating economic expansion for the state because, generally speaking, the same dollars that are going into that bakery are being diverted from Tim Hortons or another bakery. So it's not new capital coming into the state. And so the challenge that Maine has is until we have significant increase in outside capital coming in, we're just regenerating existing capital, and especially when you have so many national companies operating here, some of that capital leaves in the form of retail chains and retail businesses. So that's principle number one that goes into the Steve-O plan. More popovers is a key element. I'm kidding. But we focus on silly things. Like over the last 5 years, you know, I remember all the discussions about casinos and all the whole argument. And I was against having casinos here, basically because every study you read shows that people who are more socially, economically disadvantaged are harmed by casinos. Because you have people marching into casinos across the state, up in Bangor and out in Oxford, and they're bringing their hard-earned money. They're sitting down in front of a slot machine, and somehow, in their small thinking, small mind approach, not everyone, I don't want to, you know, we usually get thousands of pieces of mail when I say something like this, but they sit in front of a slot machine and they think they can beat the math. They think, well, I'm going to bring $200 and I have a better plan on beating the math, and whether it's slot machines or whether it's blackjack or anything else. And the reality is, in every single casino game, you can't beat the math. You know, the one game where there's kind of an exception is poker, and they only play a little bit of that in Bangor and none in Oxford, because then you're playing against other people. But in casino games, there's a set mathematical certainty out of how much money you put in, how much you get back. And yeah, over a 2-hour period, you can, you know, there's some variance. You can synthesize the feeling that you're winning. Over 2 days, you can synthesize. Over a month, you may synthesize some feeling you're winning. You can't win. So the casinos came in with the idea of, oh, we're going to put that into education fund. And now that has been attached. And now what was once supposed to be dedicated to, well, we've got to do this for the kids, is lost in the, you know, it was, let's have casinos so local people can own it. And the guy that owned Oxford just sold it to Churchill Downs a couple of years ago. So now that money's going outside of the state. And nobody's paying attention. I like Charlie Kogan, but I think he was asleep for a lot of these things. And then we were going to have fireworks. Let's get fireworks in here. Oh, man, fireworks are going to be booming, literally and figuratively. We're going to be able to tax them and everything else. Fireworks represent nothing from nothing other than kind of a safety hazard. Then the liquor tax, our latest liquor agreement. The state went to the wholesalers with a liquor contract and didn't just try to get a better deal, but literally proposed a deal that necessitated people drinking more and changing packages of liquor. So between casinos, fireworks, and liquor, those were three buttons that were pushed in the last 5 or 10 years. Totally ridiculous. So here comes the big plan. Deb, you ready?
I am.
Do we have any big plan music, or should I just kind of hear this in my head?
You hear it in your head.
Okay, I'm going to hear this in my head. Okay, we've got 35,812 something square miles here, right? We've got 488 municipalities, incorporated municipalities, and we've got 1.3 million and about 42,000 people spread out all over the place. The old economy from 200 years ago was one of natural resources and timber and textiles, and you, me, and 10 people we know would go move out in the middle of nowhere. I'd have some horses. You'd grow some potatoes. Deb would, what would you do, Deb?
Ponder climate change.
No, you wouldn't do that. You'd be teaching the kids. You love the kids. You'd be something. And so our economy would be micro-based within 2 miles or 4 miles, however far, you know, our horse could ride in a day. And it worked. You know, I traded you a couple horses. You helped me build my little cabin. We sold a couple things. Thing was great. And then the Industrial Revolution, and then we start manufacturing things. And then all of a sudden, trains, planes, and automobiles. The problem is Maine was settled 200 years ago before we knew about fiber optics. Nobody's fault. It wasn't Governor Baldacci's fault or Governor LePage's fault or the legislator's fault or Deb's fault, which I try to blame her for everything. It was a natural phenomena, right? People spread out across the state. And then over the last 20 or 30 years, moving into a technology economy and moving into away from resource-based and timber, we have this infrastructure set up that is wildly inefficient. And so it's not about shifting a few jobs, or it's not about having a couple press conferences or putting up a sign that says open for business. We've got 1.3 million people with a bunch of people spread out all over the place. And in the new economy, every mile you put between a consumer or a company in goods and services, you add inefficiency. And every study I've seen in the last 5 years shows, not just in Maine, but around the world, that urban economic environments are growing faster. Density and efficiency are the drivers for the new economy. Maine goes in the other direction. That's problem one. Problem two is, as a state, we don't have a capital reserve budget. Okay? In Yarmouth and in most municipalities, you have capital reserve. You know, in Yarmouth, we kept a few $100,000, $2 million. So when a fire truck broke down after 15 years, you anticipated when a roof came off, when a heating system. Maine now has $5.3 billion of infrastructure costs that have been pent up over the last 5 years of neglect that nobody's accounted for. The state hasn't accounted for. Governor LePage hasn't accounted for. And it has to do with bridges and waterway and healthcare support and education. So here's the plan. Deb, are you still listening?
Because
you,
of course I
you
am.
Fall asleep when I go on
no,
this particular
never,
rant.
Never.
Shani, you listening too?
I'm here.
Yeah, okay. Joel?
You just implied that this was a talk that you've given before, or a plan that you've laid out before.
I've laid this out. So here's the money section. Here's the big section. I did a study known as the Steve Study 2 years ago, where I reviewed the state's economy. I reviewed local economies in 488 municipalities. And what I identified was we have 108 at the time. It may have changed, but 108 local towns were insolvent here in Maine. And they were insolvent beyond a threshold that I identified. And the best way to kind of illustrate that is in Falmouth, where the studio is, the average taxpayer in Falmouth who puts about a dollar into the state fund through multiple mechanisms only gets about 20 cents back relative to revenue sharing, relative to infrastructure support from MDOT or anything else. So in some communities, you put in a dollar and you get a small amount back. We accept that as the social contract of being in a democracy. We accept that if America is a wealthy country, we help countries that aren't as wealthy. We accept it on the scale of if we have 50 states, some states are revenue producing for federal government, some are takers. We accept that, but there's got to be a ratio that makes sense. The problem in Maine with these 108 towns I'm talking about, there's one town, and I identified it in the paper I wrote, is Milo. which is almost in the epicenter of the state of Maine. It's about 3 hours from Canada, 3 hours from the southern border, 3 hours from the ocean, 3 hours from Vermont. They've gone through some horrible economic problems in the last few years. Dover Foxcraft, lumber and timber has gone down, and they're really struggling. But in some towns like that, when they put in a dollar into the state budget, they get between $15 and $20 back. The problem is in the ratio. The other problem is when our elected officials in Augusta set that policy, they think they're helping the people in these 108 towns. They're not. If you go to some of these towns, this isn't a day in the beach. And then it becomes multi-generational because every mile you put somebody in one of those towns from first-class health care, you're having worse health outcomes. Every mile between education or getting better education or better teachers, you're hurting the kids. Every mile you put them between job growth and job opportunities. And most of those jobs are never going to come back. And the politicians lie. They lie every time they go to get elected. And they say, elect me. I'm going to bring jobs back to this town. They can't bring jobs back because jobs is dependent on outside revenue and capital. And you're not going to go to Microsoft and go, hey, how about you build a plant in Milo? Money, electricity, and water are natural phenomena that go where they want to go. Here's what we should do in Maine. And if you want to write the paper on this, I will license you the Steve-O idea. Because, Deb, I've made this offer before to Charlie.
You have.
Do you remember how Charlie reacted? He was like, he huffed and he puffed and he goes, I'm Charlie Cogan, I'm the world's greatest economist, and you're Steve. You stayed back in Needham High and you flunked math. And I go, well, yes, I did, Charlie Cogan, but you know what? I've built six businesses. I hire people. I run a healthcare company. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing something here, Charlie. Work with me.
Right.
And I don't know. And now he's out golfing on the West Coast or something. So here was my plan. We can't have some communities in Maine putting in a dollar and getting 20 cents. And we can't have some communities putting in a dollar and getting $20, especially since we're not helping them. I identified the 108 towns, and what we need to do is come up with tax policy in a 10-year window and say to these communities, hey, we're a compassionate state. We're compassionate leaders. And on a growing scale over 10 years, that ratio of 20 to 1 has to come down to something reasonable, 10 to 1, 8 to 1, whatever. And that means less MDOT support. You don't get three bridges rebuilt. You get one. You don't get this amount of asphalt. You get this amount. And there will be some natural attrition to some of these places in Maine. But nobody wants to admit it. And 140 years ago, when the West was settled, there would be towns where the mine closed. And so somebody said, oh, the mine closed. The mine, what are we going to do? There's no economy supporting Cheyenne or something. And the people got together and they said, well, I guess we got to get the wagons. We got to go to Wichita. Nobody said, no. Let's go to Wichita and have them just pay for us to live here where there's no economy. It is insane. But there is not a single politician I've met that can understand this basic concept in terms of economic viability in a multi kind of unit state. And so my proposal is we can go to these 108 towns, which only represent about 160,000 people, literally two football stadiums. And we can say to these people in these towns, hey, nobody wants you to move. Nobody's telling you to move. This isn't Chairman Mao. This is, you know, if you want to stay, but you cannot indefinitely get this over-indexed support that's creating hurdles for the rest of the state, and it's killing us relative to our tax profile. But over 10 years, the towns are going to be getting less, still more than they're contributing, but they're going to be getting less. And by the way, if you live in one of these towns, we're going to give you a quarter-acre lot, a land grant, in one of the four economic development zones that we recognize. And there's going to be rings around places like Saco or Biddeford or Bangor where we have plenty of land. We're going to give you a quarter acre. And you know what? We're probably going to give you a modular home. And you know what? We're going to call up Mayflower van lines and we're going to move your stuff into this thing. And that will be cheaper than the state spending hundreds of millions of dollars artificially supporting underperforming municipalities. And if we move those people, or they want to go, We also help the places they move. They have greater density, greater efficiency. And if you take somebody from Milo and move them to Saco over a 10-year period, they're going to be 2.2 miles from a great healthcare facility. They're going to be 1.8 miles away from a great school system with great teachers. And they're going to be within 3 miles of 800 jobs. More efficiency. This is the big plan. We've got to get this done. We've got Joel Johnson here. He's nodding furiously, and I'm not sure if he's agreeing or not. But what do you think? That's the big plan, Joel.
I think that's crazy, Steve.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God, Joel. What do you mean that's crazy?
Well, that's...
Which part of it?
Look, I mean, we're already seeing rural areas of the state.
It's happening slowly. I mean, it's happening slowly. My point is we're losing time value, and we're putting up economic barriers that stop companies from coming in. We have to move faster. The new economy is moving fast, Joel. We have to move fast. We can't just let towns atrophy over 20 or 30 years while we dump tens of millions of dollars into subsidizing. That would be like having a 500-unit business like Home Depot, and you know 108 of them are going bankrupt, and you just keep pouring money in until the whole chain is going under. You can't do that. So you said it was crazy, and you know, that was kind of you're part of the Charlie Kogan school of thought. So tell me what part, because none of this suggests that we're going to tell people to move. What it suggests is state policy has to reflect a more reasonable ratio, that if a local community can only generate X amount of taxable income to support themselves, the state should have a restriction on what the ratio is. And if somebody in Milo can only afford $1 to put it in the tax bill, okay, well, we shouldn't do $20, $30, $40 of support, because it keeps going up and there's no mechanism to stop it. So my idea is we throttle it down to 10 to 1, which is still very compassionate, very generous. But if we don't fundamentally change the structure of the state, all these taxes on casinos, fireworks, liquor, all this revenue sharing stuff, none of this Paula Page new tax plan stuff makes any sense, because the physical infrastructure of Maine is deeply flawed.
I think kids in Milo deserve the same shot as a kid in Portland. I mean, in any other wealthier community.
But what
in
does
Maine.
That mean? They deserve the same shot.
Well, I mean, they deserve a high quality education. You know, they deserve to.
But what is it? But what does that mean? Because I think it's really important, and you're one of the state economists. What did I say in anywhere? Did it suggest that a kid? What I said was that kid does deserve quality health care and education, but he's not going to get it in Milo.
Well,
he is going to get it in some other place.
I mean, I guess when you talk about the way that the state supports local communities, I mean, what we're talking about is, like you said, roads and bridges is a big one. We're talking about health care, and we're talking about education. Now, those are the big ones.
Yeah, but
now,
revenue sharing for the Miro School District is 80 or 90%. In some of the towns down here, it's like 5 or 7%. The issue is the state and other communities are subsidizing communities that have no economic viability. And if we've given it a shot, we've tried to create jobs in some of these places, but if it's a natural phenomena that we can't create jobs because outside capital refuses to go there, why do we keep perpetuating policies that have no end? My point is, we're not – you said, and you took kind of a compassionate approach, which I respect. Yeah, the kids in Milo deserve the same break. We're trapping them in Milo. By giving them just enough so they're sustaining themselves, we're not breaking the cycle. It's not working. 30, 40 years from now, most of these communities are going to naturally decay over time. But in the meantime – our tax barriers keep going up, our population keeps getting older, and the cycle doesn't change. And so all I'm saying, I'm not saying that we're not going to help the people of Milo, but there has to be an economic ratio, right? Why wouldn't we give $40 for every dollar that came out of Milo? At what point do we use critical thinking and economics to mandate this, as opposed to let's keep doing the thing the way we've been doing in these small towns?
I mean, I think a lot of these small towns in Maine are already operating on a pretty bare bones set of public services. And
yeah.
I mean, I don't think that there's really a lot of, I guess I kind of disagree with the notion that there's all kinds of savings to be had by changing the way that the school funding formula works, or changing the way that the, you know, revenue sharing formula works.
But when a bridge needs to be rebuilt in Milo, the state doesn't measure whether there's 400 people or 1,200 people here. It's a $10 million project. And when you add that up and expand and amplify that over 100 towns, Maine has an infrastructure issue, both in terms of the physical infrastructure and the structural layout of the state. That if Maine had 10 economic zones, three large urban zones being Portland Metro, Bangor, Lewiston, Auburn, and then seven other medium-sized, whether it's Bar Harbor
or
Biddeford, Desert Island area, and then some other core areas. If we had the resources and focused on those areas and reshifted and realigned some of our priorities, Maine would have a great economy. The problem is, over thousands of miles, over hundreds of miles of asphalt, over hundreds of bridges and water treatment and stormwater treatment, you multiply that. At every mile of asphalt, you've got to put salt on. You need public safety for. It is the physical infrastructure of Maine that's killing us. And every politician in Augusta does not get that. All they get is, well, how are we going to get more money in, and where's the money going out? But if we don't fix the structural issue of our state, we're doing a disservice to the people who live here.
I think our infrastructure problem in the state is mostly about an unwillingness to fund infrastructure. I mean, every year we have the DOT lays out what is the investment that we need to meet statutory obligations for roads and bridges to get them up to basically just a safe and reliable level. And every year we fund about 2/3 of that level. And the reason is because we don't have the gumption to raise the money for it, and through the gas tax, which is perfectly serviceable way of funding roads and bridges, and yet we just consistently we have a chronic shortfall going on in the highway fund.
Oh yeah,
that just for some reason there's not much momentum there to fix it. I think that's a big problem, but I kind of disagree generally with just the notion that there's all kinds of savings to be had through some sort of redistribution. I think that we're already operating on a pretty low bare bones level.
Should we let a town be a ghost town? If there's no jobs and there's no underlying economy, which I'm asking you as an economist, we have Joel Johnson here in the studio. He is with the Maine Center for Economic Policy. It's such an emotional issue that it's hard for many politicians to kind of grapple with it, because there's this human compassion element to it, which I am sensitive to. What I'm trying to do is help everyone in Maine. But the current policy is clearly not working. We're worst on every list. We're worst on economic development, business list.
I don't think that's true.
On many, many lists where we are near the bottom on lists that are tied to kind of economic viability. On many lists, on lists in terms of fun places to go and coffee shops and tourism things?
Ernst & Young came out with a report a few years ago that said that Maine was the number one state in the country for the business investment climate. And it had to do with the way that our corporate income tax was structured, the way that we apportion corporate income. It had to do with a variety of things. But I guess I kind of just reject the notion that the reality is Maine is in the middle of the pack on a lot of economic indicators, and I'm not sure. I guess I don't necessarily buy the kind of doomsday argument or the doomsday trajectory that you're suggesting that we're on. And I also don't think that the fate of a lot of these small towns, you know, in the future is necessarily a bleak one. I mean, I think that there's a lot of opportunity in. You know, you talked about technology. I mean, in some ways, technology is actually making the physical distance between places less important, not more important.
I've heard the argument, and our good friend Charlie Kogan met that, and I disputed that as being fantasy. And yes, I work in technology every day. You're sitting in a building where we do digital communication around the world. And on one hand, technology has allowed connectivity over different areas into rural areas, which is a good thing. But the idea, again, we've got to get back to the concept of capital investment. Outside companies, if you're talking about technology, need more skilled workers. And you may be able to hire 100 skilled workers to work in a rural town in Maine, but you may not be able to get them to live there because at 5 o'clock they're in that rural town in Maine. And there's not a Panera, and there's not a Chipotle, and there's not a movie theater, and there's not the social infrastructure that people Shani's age would be gravitate to. And so there's no way to synthesize or to create or 3D print infrastructure that creates a vital, viable digital economy in rural Maine. And so just because we can extend fiber optics and broadband doesn't mean the companies are going to invest the millions of dollars to build companies and infrastructure. And so I've heard lots of arguments. I've sat through lots of economic development policy meetings. I've had a lot of bad muffins and cold coffee while people sat in conference rooms at hotels and put Post-it notes on the wall suggesting, oh, this will be good. Why don't we get biotech? Why don't we do this? It is illusion. It is fantasy. We have to lower the tax barriers, lower the hurdles, create greater density zones of skilled workers, and then business will come. We should be the annex of suburban Boston. There are billions of dollars of pent-up demand for medical tech, IT, biotech, where we could build infrastructure. It's not going to happen in some of these rural places. And until we have people in policy-setting roles that recognize and speak the hard truth and the difficult truth, if this was a tsunami in Japan, which they had a few years ago, and it was a natural phenomena, and the government says, hey, there's a tsunami, the nuclear plant broke down, we've got to move 100,000 people. People go, well, okay, I accept that. It's nuclear. It's a tsunami. We have an economic tsunami that's affecting Maine's infrastructure, and nobody wants to recognize it because everyone's blaming other people and hanging on to some fantasy that technology is going to save us. Deb, you're going to back. Do I get an amen?
Amen, okay. Brother. Amen. I totally agree with what you are saying 100%. I'm serious. I do.
I know, but we in Maine are so nice. I love that about Maine. That's why I moved here. But we're afraid of having the hard discussions. As I said before, let's get more casinos. Let's get some more fireworks. Let's get people to drink more booze. Those aren't fundamental things that we need in our economy. What we need are outside companies looking at Maine, looking at our skill set. We need to redo our education. We've got too much physical infrastructure in terms of our education system. And it's not about taking five school systems and five principals and making it one principal. Yeah, there's some administrative savings. It is a physical phenomena based on physics of time, space, and distance. The new economy going forward over the next 50 years will favor density efficiency. And if Maine's not competitive in this country, if Maine's not competitive globally, we're going to be disadvantaged. And we're going to have to save this interview, Joel, and play this back 30 years from now. I'll be like a crazy old man. Hopefully I'll be still running around. You'll be kind of sort of an old man. And because I'm passionate about this. And all the meetings, and you're a policy guy. By the way, we have Joel Johnson here. He's a policy guy. And he's one of Maine's best and brightest. And he has a master's in resource economics and policy. But we need to have hard discussions. We can't keep having breakfast meetings on, you know, we're going to envision Maine this. We're going to, you know, power this. We're going to have another press conference on this because a bakery opened. If we don't have real people setting real policy and in speaking real truth to our citizens, we're doing a disservice. And it starts with our economy. And that's the greatest impact. We've got food insecurity issues in our state that we don't even get to talk to because we've got thousands of kids that are literally starving. And in the summertime, because they don't have school system food support, they're really starving because there's no other mechanism. We have heat insecurity. We're one of the least insulated, highest fuel-using states in the place. So I love Maine, but every time I try to tell this truth, people say, oh, Steve, you're being negative. You're not. No, we need more people hitting the table going, we can solve this. It's physics. Here's the amount of space we have. Here's the amount of people. Here are the economics. We can solve it, but we can't solve it out of some sort of emotional-based processing of, oh, we've got to be nice to the people in this town, and we can't do this. We will help all the people of Maine if we create a better economic platform.
And, you know, people in Maine are tough in general. We have gone through hard lives. We can handle the truth when it's given to us in a reasonable way, like you've spelled it out to us here today.
Yeah.
If people didn't try to make everything rosy all the time, we would probably be able to have some of these solutions on the table already.
Somebody should go to some of these towns that lose big timber plants and say, hey, we would like to get more jobs here. We would aspire to that. But, you know, if we're really being honest, we got to tell you, the economy in this town or this town is very little chance of it coming back for all these reasons. Let's admit that, and then let's figure out a way over the next 5 or 10 years to make your lives better. But if every year all we do is tell those people, oh, no, no, elect me, it'll get better. Elect me, I'll help you get more money for schools. Elect me, I'll get more money for this. Elect me, I'll try to get a job here. We're lying to them. There are some towns in Maine right now that if we took a snapshot and we look 10, 20 years from now, they would be 90% less in terms of population and their local economy. We can project that now, but we don't want to tell those people there because we're just too nice. And out of the three people here, Joel looks like your guy in your 30s, right? Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that. Deb, you're
don't say. Don't
born
say.
During the Eisenhower's era. We've got Shanny McShanny, who's kind of a 20-something, low 30-something. We need people in their early 20s to come here and to vitalize our economy. And we're doing it. You know, 9 out of 10 new jobs are in the three big urban metro areas. That's not a coincidence. It has to do with, if you're a 22-year-old person, it's not just, oh, where can I find a job? It's, what am I going to do this weekend? Or where am I going to go at 6 o'clock? You know, and we have so many communities in Maine that nobody even addresses that. We need to come up with direct, real policy. Did we solve anything here today, Joel? I won't really, because now that I chased Charlie Cogan out of the state, I was very, very hopeful to get the new and improved Charlie Cogan, who's Joel Johnson. He works with the Center for Economic Policy here. And I'm joking. You've been a good sport listening to my rant. But we have some real challenges and real issues, and I think it's great that you and other people working with you are trying to find solutions. I just feel a sense of urgency that's greater than I've seen in many of the legislative and policy-making areas of the state.
Yeah, I guess I don't think trying to actively make life harder in Maine's rural areas is going to help anything.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. I hope you'll come back. I hope you're not leaving bruised or anything. You're like, what was that? Because I know that from talking to you, I'm sure you love Maine, and you know everything you do professionally is geared to try to make things better here. I feel the same way. Mm. And at least we had a good discussion about it.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Yeah.
This was Joel Johnson. He's an economist, Maine Center of Economic Policy. Their website is .mecep.org. And you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Thank you for listening.